In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Right, sales and marketing teams, the Alpha Awards are back, and it's time to nominate your business development heroes. On the 1st of May, Alpha Insight, the UK's leading business development platform for the media industry, will be hosting a night of celebration for the best salespeople in the business. Whether you want to showcase a new business initiative, your account management team, purposeful partnership, or a rising star, there's a chance for your team to be recognized in the spotlight in front of key industry leaders, clients, and indeed their peers and yours. So get your entries in now at www.alfawards.com. That's ALFAwards.com. Good luck. Hello and welcome to On Brand with Alf and me, Rory Sutherland. Each month, I'll be talking to household names as well as challenger brands about success, challenges, and future opportunities in the advertising, marketing, and media industry. Today, I'm joined by Lene de Jongst. Lena is the co-founder and chief evangelist of Air Up, the world's first drinking system that flavors water just by scent, and I have one on the desk right in front of me. Now, Lena developed the prototype for Air Up during her university thesis at the University of Schwäbische Gmünd, and Lena launched the product in 2019. Air Up now operates in 11 markets and has doubled its workforce to more than 300 employees while enjoying a customer base in the millions. Air Up bottles have exploded in popularity this year and are now a disruptive force in the soft drinks industry. So, Lena, welcome to the podcast. And just before I get started, I just thought, for anybody who hasn't seen an Air Up bottle, I have one on my desk in front of me. Effectively, what happens is you have a bottle which you fill with tap water. You then pass it through a straw, and you have two options. You have a little capsule that goes around the nozzle, the teat at the top of the bottle. And you can pull that up, and when you pull it up, you'll hear the noise now, it both slightly aerates the water and flavours it with your choice of coffee flavour. I think this one's watermelon, actually, if I've got that right. If you want to, you can push the little round thing down, and you drink just straight water out of the bottle. But essentially, if I'm right, before we get started, this effect works largely through scenting the water, not through flavouring it. Is that right?
Yes.
Which is why the capsule can be so small.
Yes, right.
In many ways, it's a perceptual innovation in that taste and smell are hugely interrelated. It's impossible to enjoy food if the restaurant you're in smells.
Right.
And equally, if you make something smell nice, it changes the way you experience taste. So, but tell me what your thesis was on. Was it on kind of psychophysics and human perception? Or was it on or phenomenology? Well, what does the University of Schwäbische Gmünd offer in terms of this kind of research? Because it's so rare for a university thesis to actually lead to something useful that I think this deserves special consideration.
I think they would love to hear that, my professors, if they heard that quote. But yes, so I was studying product design together with my today co-founder, Tim. And this was our bachelor thesis. And when you study product design, most of the times you're quite free to do whatever you want. The only goal is you have to get a physical product out at the end. And so we were actually coming from a neuroscientific place. So we watched a TED Talk from a neuroscientist called David Eagleman. He was explaining in his TED Talk how our sensory perception works and why it would make sense to augment our sensory perception in some ways, and maybe also to manipulate it, because our sensory perception in general hasn't changed over decades, but our environment has changed a lot. So we thought, okay, this is very interesting. Maybe we can tap into that. And then we were looking for a product category where it could be useful to change your sensory perception. And of course, I mean, food and drinks is a very sensory topic, and it's connected to a lot of problems that result from it. And we found out that basically the reason why we eat so much unhealthy stuff is because we're just drawn to good flavors. Because our brain tells us to eat sweet stuff and savory stuff, because back in the days, this was important for us to survive, right? So we thought, okay, how cool would it be if we could create a flavor without having to add all those unhealthy ingredients? And we stumbled across the topic of retronasal olfaction. So that's how the scientific effect is called. So basically, when you chew on food or when you drink something, then aromas get extracted and they get perceived by the back of your throat, by your nose, as flavor. So, and when we found out that, we thought, okay, that's cool. Maybe that's the way to simulate flavor without having to add sugar, salt, and so on and so forth. And that's how the first prototype basically was built.
Because what fascinates me about so much about design and conception of new products is they optimize for objective factors, not subjective factors. And you don't actually have to produce a drink that tastes of something. You have to produce the sensation that the drink tastes of something. And therefore, it's perfectly possible to hack that. And I think actually the biggest misdirection of quite often in all forms of innovation is this is in some ways what my TED talk was about. Don't try and make the train faster. Instead, make the train journey more enjoyable so people don't care how long it takes. And we don't tend to do that because scientists tend to start with kind of SI units or quantities or chemicals. And really, we should your television is this screen in front of us is optimized for perception in that it only has
100%,
to produce red, green, and blue, because the human eye, the cones in the human eye, only detect relative measures of red, green, and blue. And therefore, there's no point in having violet pixels, because you can effectively create that effect with the three colors that the brain's attuned to. TVs are actually, they're species specific. So I think higher primates, I think gorillas would think that TVs were quite realistic, but your dog or your parrot would think your TV picture is rubbish because they have a different perception. I think it's incredibly important because, I mean, it's very important to me air up, by the way, for two reasons. I'm just going personal here. I've just had some sort of prostate surgery, which means that for 3 months I can't drink caffeine. And I also can't drink, it's either called aspartame or aspartame, and I have no idea which it is.
Yeah.
Because both of those things tend to trigger the bladder. And as a consequence, I suddenly realized it's really quite hard to find a drink that isn't full of either sugar or aspartame or caffeine. Okay. And so Air Up came to the rescue here, rather, along with, funnily enough, a previous guest on the show, Dash, I think is similar. It's a canned drink. It's made with wonky fruit. And effectively, it uses the fruit to provide essentially sensory flavor rather than actual, you know, huge quantities of fruit. But it's very, very interesting in this thing, partly because also the other reason I find this useful is I grew up in Wales, where the tap water is excellent. It tastes lovely. It's very soft water. And Wales, you never have to descale your washing machine. If you want to save money on the Calgon, just move to Wales. By contrast, the water here in the southeast, the ghastly Anglo-Saxon water, is very, very hard, which is probably good for you, but it tastes right. By comparison with the water of my childhood, it tastes rubbish. And let's be honest, okay, I've got to be careful saying this, but uncarbonated water is kind of a bit boring. I mean, it's interesting that your product allows you that option. I can push the little thing down, and here we go. That's water. Pull it up. And it's flavored with watermelon. And as far as my senses go, I'm drinking a flavored drink. I have no capacity to separate the scent from the taste, if you like.
Yeah, that's actually the important thing to mention. A lot of, there were products before that tried to scent to simulate flavor through scent. But what those people who worked on those products did is was they used authonasal olfaction. So that means that you inhale the scent through your nose instead of exhaling it through your nose. And that way the brain will perceive the scent as scent and the flavor as flavor. But the other way around, when you do the retronasal olfaction, then actually the brain cannot differentiate. And that's the whole trick. And that's why it's so important that the scent comes into your mouth.
Got it? Because when it's going in reverse, your nose is effectively feeding into the flavor sensors in the brain. Whereas when it comes in through your nostrils, that's when effectively you can separate what you smell from what you taste.
Yes.
This is ingenious. This is the most brilliant brain. I've often wondered about this, by the way, which is to say that what you might call the systemic threat to huge billion-dollar industries is to some extent perceptual. I've always wondered, if you could produce a drug that just made you feel really well-dressed, okay, you could kill the worldwide fashion industry, you know. Now, you could argue, I might argue that for men, and you're from Munich anyway, so you'll know this anyway, four pints of strong lager, broadly speaking, achieve that effect in men. In that once you drink four pints of strong lager, you're convinced you're incredibly sophisticated, attractive, and a brilliant dancer, okay? And so if you could create these kind of what you might call consumer substitute drugs, okay, you could actually, from an environmental point of view, actually killing a large part of the fashion industry would probably be quite good news. Anyway, if there's any evil scientist out there who wants to actually produce the Vogue drug, which basically just makes you feel like a Vogue model, even if you're just wearing, you know, crumpled old clothes, well, I'm
that
your first
would be very
customer.
Nice.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Or instead, you just drink the four pints of lager, right?
Exactly. Or just have four pints of lager, which works quite well. I mean, so tell us more about your background and how it came about. What made you decide to do product design? And have you always been fascinated by that? Or was this kind of partly accidental?
Well, in some ways accidental, but also it was my passion. So I loved drawing. So I wanted to get into arts, but then I realized at a certain point, okay, arts is very abstract in a way. Not sure if I can make a living out of it. So I got into some internships. So I worked for a blacksmith. I worked for someone who works with wood and metal, and I loved it. So I applied for product design because I thought I could connect this handcraft with my love for art and drawing. And then I realized, so it was very, like, I came from the very other end, but during the study, I realized what I really enjoy about the study is actually the inventor part, right? So to conceptualize, to bring different things together, to connect the dots, and by the end of it, create an idea out of it that you actually, by the end of the day, is not just existing in one's head, but you can also realize it through prototyping and so on and so forth. So that's how I got into product design, and I still love it. So,
yeah, I completely agree, by the way. I mean, I think that a very, very large part of improvement, I think the two areas really to look for improvement in quality of life are not, it's, you know, economics assumes it's more stuff. I think that, you know, the two things we really need are better design stuff and effectively better psychology and marketing. And I think if you want me to be cynical about the technology world, We tend to assume that the good products succeed and the bad ones fail. We tend to assume there's this kind of Darwinian process at work. I think that process does work over decades, perhaps. But I think there's not, you know, because, you know, unless you know how to market the things that are genuinely enduringly good, unless you know how to design them well, you'll still fail even if your basic idea is really good. Now, I want to make a comment that this Air Up flask, which I have in front of me, is very beautifully designed. It intelligently curves over at an angle to make it much pleasanter to drink. Intelligently, the straw the straw does not go down to the bottom of the bottle. It goes down to the bottom and the edge so that you can effectively get nearly all of the water out. Well, it's obvious, but it's obvious in retrospect, if you like. It's a very beautifully designed thing. So you patently put attention to that. It's something, because as we know, that water bottle culture among young people is a fairly major thing. And it looks great. I mean, I have to say that. I mean, you have a choice of colours, a choice of sizes, and so forth. And the and also the packaging for the pods is very, very nice. Now, how did you first, when you first started, you presumably, obviously, you make a prototype, and the prototype works. When you went into manufacture, what were your first ideas for how to market it, how to find distribution, how to promote it? Because, of course, when you create a new category, one of the things I'll say to anyone listening, okay, if you create a new category of anything, growth at first is slow, okay? You know, first of all, who do you talk to at a supermarket or a shop? Because it doesn't fit into any of their pre-existing categories of what you sell, you know? And so that's where it gets really, really interesting. And also, how do you distribute the pods? I mean, obviously, you do it online. That's one great spur to innovation, which is, you know, consumables can be sold online across 11 markets fairly easily. But what was your first step once production kicked up and started running?
Yeah, so I think, first of all, what was interesting from a physical development perspective is that we had 3 months for our bachelor thesis. We had the idea, or we stumbled across retronasal affection by half through the project. So we had 1.5 months to actually create the physical prototype, which was in the end functioning. So we had the basic technology, and we had a first very simple prototype, but we had a prototype. And from that, it took us 1.5 years to bring it to production. So it was a lot about the small details. Like, it's a lot about how can you produce a product in a way that it is affordable for us, at the same time has a high quality and has, you avoid a lot of the errors that could appear in usage of the product. So that was a huge process for us. And while we were working on the manufacturing part, that was the time where we thought, okay, but like, we had our first thoughts about how to market the product. And initially, we thought a lot about creating a product for people who have diabetes, because that was the most obvious choice, right? So we thought, okay, this is actually, it applies to a lot of health problems that people have. A lot of people also can't drink or consume acidic beverages. Some people have problem with sparkling beverages. A lot of beverages have sparkling water that have a flavor. So there were a lot of reasons to go into the med tech space. But then we realized, okay, once we have we go down that route, we kind of exclude the whole lifestyle factor. Like the whole lifestyle factor around the product. And we knew we needed that in order to build a brand. That was one side. The thing we considered in the beginning was, okay, we knew our product was especially attractive to kids, because a lot of course, kids have even a stronger urge to drink sweetened beverages, and parents really would like to save their kids from consuming a lot of sugar. So we thought, okay, that could be also interesting. But at the same time, we not wanted to build up a kids brand from bottom, because we wanted to be attractive for both target groups. And so by the end of the day, we launched the product as a lifestyle product with targeted to the Gen Z, and it had a lot of effects afterwards. Also, now, like 50% of our target group are actually kids, so it's quite interesting how that went down that route. The other thought that we have was like, where to place our product. And in the beginning, we thought, okay, that was pre-corona. We thought, okay, a beverage is bought normally in the supermarket, so we thought, okay, we need to get into retail, but retail comes up with a lot of downsides as well, because it's a lot of effort to get into the supermarkets, and especially in Germany where we started, there are not a lot of centralized supermarket chains, right?
So they're two huge ones, I suppose, in Lidl and Aldi, but you don't want to end up in the middle aisle there when you launch. I think it's probably best.
Yeah, right. Also, it was a little bit of a branding question.
So
in the beginning, actually, we launched our product in retail, basically, and over Amazon, because we weren't able to finalize our web shop before launching the product. But shortly after, so in 2020, we decided to go to D2C first and sell our product mainly over our webshop, because it gave us the biggest control over consumer data, over price point, over how to position the product. It was a lot less effort for us to do that. And we realized, okay, we can also explain our product online through videos, through influencers, and people would understand it and still be curious enough to buy it. Because our thought was initially, okay, this is a completely new technology. People need to try it before they would be interested in buying it. So we did a lot of testings also in supermarkets and so on and so forth. But we realized we don't need to do it. And therefore, we decided to launch our product, or not launch, but to sell our product mainly through our webshop.
I think the role of those influencers, particularly for new things, there's another tip I'd give you. I'm sure you've explored this already, but QVC and effectively infomercials, which is that something that's fundamentally new requires you can't really sell it in 30 seconds, because as you said, you have multiple target audiences. We all know that funny thing, if you've ever watched QVC or infomercial, it's very handy if you're diabetic. It's extremely useful if you have kids, because you're saving a lot of money when you don't have to buy carbonated beverages. It's great for this. You can do it. Now, we always laugh at that, you know, where you have, you know, people selling things, pointing out, you know, a whole plethora of benefits. Actually, in the early days of a product, that's probably, and QVC has launched some really interesting DTC products. But influencers are, in a sense, QVC for the 23rd century. The 21st century. And I think you made a strategic decision. By the way, very interesting. It's amazing how many widely useful products start off having a kind of medical or disability angle, which is the absolute core target audience is, say, diabetics, because they have a fundamental problem. And that remains true, but what you often find when you design for a very specific problem is that you solve an awful lot of problems that radiate out. There's a great book by Helen Edwards called From Marginal to Mainstream. How about the interesting trends often start on the fringe of something? You could obviously talk about veganism being another example. But actually, it's not a bad policy in product design to say, let's take a core group, and then ask the question, how far does it radiate out? Now, I'll tell you an extraordinary story about this. If you buy a tray, you want a drinks tray because you want to take a pot of tea and some cups or mugs into the next room, okay? 99% of the trays in the world don't have a handle. You have to use both hands, which makes it really difficult getting through a door. And you have to keep the thing level with both hands every step of the way. You can buy trays with a handle. They're either in niche kind of craft shops and they're positioned as like Moroccan handle tray, or you go to a disability store. Now, I bought all my father and my parents-in-law, I bought them this tray with that. You only need one hand, which means you can go upstairs without losing the grip on the banister. You could open doorknobs, etc. Now, in a sense of world, every single tray would come with a handle, because it also means that gravity does the job of keeping the tray level, okay? In every respect, it's a much, much better idea. But what's happening effectively is that designing for a disability, what you often find, it's rather like, you know, if you take wheelchair ramps, well, they're very useful for people who've got wheelie suitcases. And there are so many cases where you realize that you solve for a specific problem and you solve a general problem. So, by the way, I think the use of influencers, that was a kind of strategic decision, because it's a new product. We need people to effectively normalize something. And it is, I think it's the right channel in the early stages of some product. I can completely see how it just requires a little more lengthy exposition than you can get in, certainly in banner ads or whatever. Not that those might not work. But the other advantage, of course, of D2C, I suppose, is that you have the model, the influencer gets effectively the credit for resulting sales. You also then have the data with which you can sell the consumables. So,
right.
Those are quite conveniently, of course. Delivering soft drinks by post is obviously pretty expensive. Delivering what are fairly light, not very voluminous pods. So have you explored the subscription model? You presumably have, because I just buy mine direct. Presumably one option is a subscription model where you just have repeat purchase.
Yeah, we are right now having a test within the Dutch market, but actually the UK comes next. So,
right. Perfect.
We got your back, Rory.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you.
Of course, subscription model makes total sense. We actually, we had a few tests, and we now have a proper tech team that can take care of it. Because, I mean, we also realized at a certain point, okay, we're a physical product company, but actually the one thing that we work with most, or our biggest sales channel, is our web shop, and we can improve that by a lot. So right now we're also working on an improved web shop. We have a proper tech team set up, and they are also taking care of subscription model for us.
That's really, really useful. That's fantastic. Interestingly, Dash has made a great success of the subscription model. And I suspect part of the reason is that what you spotted initially is that there are a certain number of people who don't want to consume sugar. There are a certain number of people who don't want to consume artificial sweeteners. There are a certain number of people who don't want caffeine. And if you're in any of those three categories, actually you're weirdly ill-served by the soft drinks market. Obviously there's water, but as I said, there are limits. I mean, I always remember talking to people who don't drink alcohol. They said, you know, they actually get very grumpy when people attack Diet Coke, because they say, seriously, they said, if you go to a party, what am I supposed to drink? And yeah. we are getting better at sort of adult, no alcohol kind of drinks.
Yeah.
But they always said, look, you've got to have something, some kind of stimulant. They said that, you know, there's this fundamental problem, which is people serve you water, which gets boring, or orange juice, which is not really tolerable beyond a certain volume. You know, it's absurdly.
Yes.
It's absurdly heavy in fructose. And it's odd that such a variegated market, in a way, with so much variety, and I suppose the typical finding is that there are lots of people who are kind of gluten intolerant or avoid gluten, possibly for entirely spurious reasons. I mean, for every one person who's genuinely celiac, there must be now 10,000 people who claim some sort of gluten intolerance. And so that trend of effectively avoiding things is undoubtedly growing. People are trying to limit, in a sense, you know, people are actually setting up almost sort of dietary laws for themselves. And I think that's interesting.
And it's also what's super interesting about the technology that we use, and the way we use aromas as well, is that for people who are allergic to certain flavors, right? A lot of people are allergic to certain types of fruit or whatever, different types of food in general. Those people can still enjoy the flavor through our technology. So everything that you can smell is also, we can deliver as a flavor through our technology, and also can deliver flavors that you would normally not consume because they're maybe not healthy, or they're just not unusual maybe to drink with a beverage. So,
you've got the coffee. Have you thought of doing the same for hot drinks? Does the thing work theoretically?
100%. So what's quite interesting is that, of course, also, like, if you consume warm water with like a punch flavor or like a tea flavor or whatever, like hot wine,
a bold wine, we call it. Yeah. So your Christmas markets, you can replicate.
So the temperature of the water, if it has sparkles or not, it really influences your flavor perception. So we of course thought about it. The problem is right now that as we have a straw and system works with a straw, if you put in hot water, of course you easily burn your tongue. So we are not advertising for it. Yeah, it has an influence on your flavor perception. And you could, of course, also, I mean, this is nothing we advertise as well. It's not the idea of the product, but of course you could put in like other drinks like milk or whatever and to mix it with different flavors. So it opens also the opportunity to really experiment with flavors in a very easy and very convenient way.
This is fascinating because, I mean, there are two things that are going on here, which I think are really interesting. Nobody would have predicted, I think, in my childhood, that one of the major trends in 2020 would be effectively abstinence. In other words, removing things rather than adding them. So one of my most recent podcasts, I'll get them as guests on the show, are people called Mash Gang, who make very low alcohol beer. It's 0.5%.
I think
they would make no alcohol beer. They argue that it's much more difficult to make no alcohol beer than low alcohol beer if you want to make it palatable. There are these extraordinary achievements. I don't know if you've tried this, whether it's in Germany yet. Zero alcohol Guinness. It's extraordinary in the sense that, and to an extent, okay, even large things are psychological. So you can actually have a convivial evening. I mean, the other people we're interested in, by the way, have a look at a company called Sentia, S-E-N-T-I-A, which is kind of co-founded by Professor David Nutt, who was the government's kind of drug czar. And this is, by the way, you should definitely investigate these guys, because it basically creates the, what you might call the conviviality of alcohol without the impairment.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a thing which activates GABA receptors. So these basic mind hacks, perceptual hacks. Now, the other thing that's really interesting is that, by the way, the color magenta, as you know, doesn't exist, okay? It doesn't exist on the light spectrum. It's simply because when you get a lot of two colors and you don't get any, if I'm right, it's red, green, blue. And if you get a lot of red and blue and you don't get any green, the brain goes, well, halfway between red and blue is green, but my green cones aren't being triggered. So I need to create a mental color for the inexplicable absence of green. And the brain comes up with magenta, which is a color that doesn't exist in physics. It's not on the light spectrum. Okay, it's a complete mental creation. Now, one of the things, there's a guy at the University of Oxford called Charles, I'll remember his name in a second, who basically points out that you can create totally new tastes by hacking psychology. And he produces these things which look, it looks like a lemon, but it tastes of strawberries. And because your expectation is, I'm going to get bitterness here, it's going to be a really heavy citrus fruit, and then you get hit with a whack of strawberry, effectively, the combination of expectation and experience creates a third taste that didn't really exist before. It's really, really interesting.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Top two challenges, brought to you by ALF Insight.
ALF Insight helps media owners, agencies and marketing service providers improve their new business pipelines by equipping them with in-depth insights, accurate information and daily news updates on the leading and challenger brands in the UK. ALF also helps sports clubs, venues and charities win new partnership deals. ALF Insight identifies the brands to target at the right time, providing everything you need to tailor the perfect pitch visit ALF Insight, that's ALFinsight.com, or click the link in the episode description to find out more. We have this little thing called Top Two Challenges. And it's you launched AirUp back in 2019. So reaching a million in that time is pretty much proof of success. And there have been many global events since then, obviously launched pre-pandemic, which may have been either bonus or a cost. I'm not quite sure. And it impacted even the most established global companies. So what's been the biggest challenge getting AirUp to market and growing to your first million or so customers? What was the biggest challenge? And the second question is, what do you think is the challenge? What do you think are the challenges facing the, let's say, the cold drinks market as a whole? We'll probably leave out tea and coffee just to keep it reasonably constrained.
All right. Yes. So for the first challenge, I mean, it's hard to really separate the challenges itself. It was just a challenging time as a founder, so to get everything started. But I would say the biggest decision for us was, as we talked about before, to decide against retail and to decide for D2C, because that helped us also to internationalize.
Which 11 markets are you in? One market's presumably the EU, a second one's presumably the UK. We won't get into that. What are the have you gone to the United States or North America yet?
Yes. So we're mostly the EU, and then we launched our product last year in June in the US.
Got it.
So, yeah. And for us, it was a big, it was a very good decision to take, because if we would have launched our product always through retail, then we wouldn't have been able to internationalize as fast, because through that, we didn't have to build up companies on ground. We were able to do that through the personnel we already had within the company. Sure, we profited from also having people from the different countries to, I don't know, when it comes to communication and all of that, and we had to build up logistics behind it and so on and so forth. But we're quite good at launching our product, and we call it a scrappy way, in a new market, to test first, like, and to build up brand awareness until we take decisions like going into retail and investing into above the line marketing activities and so on and so forth. So I think that was a huge, it was a very good strategic decision. And I think in general, the biggest challenge that we had was to, we grew massively. So just to give a little bit of context, in 2019, we launched in Germany. We made 2 million revenue in 2019. Wow. Within a few months. 2020, it was already 20 million. The year after, it was 90 million. Last year, it was 160 million almost. So it was a huge growth. And with that, of course, we had to build up structures within the company, build out logistics, make our product development more efficient. We also invested massively into bringing production from China to Europe. So there was a lot of projects going on at the same time. While also, you know, I mean, we just came from university. For us, it was
of course. This is astounding. This is really amazing as a story.
Yeah.
I mean, it deserves, by the way, I hope after this podcast, it will feature a lot more in, business cases, because that's an astonishing rate of growth. What's the repeat use like? I mean, you must be able to effectively clock, because of your D2C model, how many people are renewing their pods.
What's interesting is that those people who use it use us on a daily basis, and we assume from the data that we have that people use our pods for around 11 days.
Got it. That's yeah. Really, really interesting. Which,
yeah.
One really important thing from a behavioral science point of view is to let them know, in some respects, when they order, how many liters of liquid they've consumed and how much that would cost if
yes.
they were buying it in canned or bottle form. Because there's always the danger that things that are actually saving you money can seem expensive at the time you're buying them.
Yes.
And so that's, 100%. You know, it'd be really interesting if you actually had a kind of prediction of how many liters of, in other words, tell people how many liters of water a pod flavors, which I guess is about 11, is it? It's about 11.
No, it's around 5 liters.
That's a huge quantity of liquid. So making sure that price framing is made clear to people that they're saving money, they're not really spending. And I suppose that's why it's very popular with kids, because parents suddenly notice that your kid's carbonated beverage budget is actually quite high.
Yeah, that's true. And one other challenge we have is that the special thing about the technology we use is when you use scent, the flavor doesn't stop abruptly, right? So it's not like from one moment to the other, there's no flavor anymore. And then people realize, okay, I need to get a new pod. So that's something also we want to work on, because what happens if it slowly fades out is that people kind of get used to it. And then like after like a certain time, like, yeah, it kind of still tastes something, right? So it's also something that we can improve upon, because the feedback is important for people.
By the way, I mean, that means it's a high engagement product. One of the other things it says, email people quite a lot whenever you have a new flavor, whenever you have anything new coming out.
Yeah.
Don't, because people, what's crazy is you get thousands of emails for things you're not interested in, and things you are interested in, people email you too infrequently. And so those kind of repeat communications, anytime you've got a new flavor, use it as an opportunity to sell more, because I think that the world seems to divide into company. I went to see the Houston. Don't ever get on a US emailing database. I went to see the Houston Astros while I was in Houston.
Yeah.
Now, don't get me wrong, I like baseball to an extraordinary degree for a British person, but I don't think I need an email every day telling me what's happening at the Astrodome. So there is this absolutely bizarre divide between companies which just spam you to death and companies which are far too diffident and reticent about what they're doing. So one thing, however often you're emailing people, double it, because it's a high engagement product, which is also newsworthy and conversation worthy. That's one great advantage you have, which is the whole thing is effectively, it's rather like that Seth Godin book, Purple Cow. You've created a product which is inherently conversational, like the air fryer, okay? Is it dishwasher proof? I need to ask, because I was never quite sure. It is, I think, dishwasher proof. Not the pod, obviously, but the other components.
Yeah, we have now a second generation bottle that is dishwasher proof.
I think this is the second generation, isn't it?
Yes, you have the second generation.
I've got the second generation, excellent. Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Sorry, dishwashers feature rather too heavily in my conversation, so I'll move on. Then, as far as the second top challenge in terms of, well, I mean, it may be an opportunity. Yeah. Are you getting actually serious interest for acquisition from large drinks companies? You must have had a few large companies sniffing around.
What's interesting was that I think we haven't even started yet to sell our product, and we already knew from friends who were working at like other beverage companies that they had us within their strategy decks, right? So,
very interesting.
Like, beverage companies did pay us a lot of attention from early days on, because I think we were just such a different animal within the space. And actually, I think one of the little innovations in the market for a lot of years, because I mean, what the beverage industry did over years was to just adapt recipes for beverages, right? So the ingredient list. But what was hardly ever touched was the overall, thinking about the flavor perception maybe from a different direction. And I think what also makes us interesting is that we have, we are in the intersection of two markets. The one is the drinking bottle market.
Of course.
So it's we have a lifestyle component. We have a tech component even, because it's not easy to replicate our product. And at the same time, we do have the foods market, so something that people buy on a continuous base. So that makes us quite interesting for investors and also
you have a platform play essentially, which means if you create a system in the way of espresso, you do create a kind of moat, because you have the sunk cost investment in the device itself, and then the repeat purchase. Because it's hard to create a platform play, but when you do, a system play, but when you do, it tends to have more enduring advantages. And I imagine you've got the patents all sorted. I don't provide legal advice.
Yeah, that was what was very unusual, and which is basically a gold nugget that you rarely ever find as a product designer, is that there was no one ever using retronasal olfaction before in a product. So that was super lucky, and we got a great advantage out of it.
Do you think you're going to engage in some above-the-line advertising eventually? Or is word of mouth and the influencer campaign successful enough on its own? I would argue that you reach a stage where it's a good idea to do mass advertising simply because the act of doing mass advertising says this is a thing. You know, it's common, it's popular, it's repeatedly popular. But do you have plans for that at all?
Yeah, so we actually do now start the first TV flights as tests.
Ah, good.
And we only do that, and we had a out-of-home campaign end of the year in Germany, something we have never done before because it was just too risky to do for us. The first goal for us was to understand how to communicate to customers in an effective way, and you can simply learn best through online marketing because you have opportunities to test A and B messaging against each other and better understand, okay, what works best.
Brilliant.
Like, good, how do people testing. Understand Love our it. Product best? Mm. Mm. And also it allowed us to be very cost efficient. And now we have a little bit more financial buffer to actually also go with a bigger risks, which is for us out of home or TV, because you just have to invest a bigger chunk of money beforehand without knowing if it's going to work or not.
You haven't, I think, by the way, I think you're right in this, but this given you launched in Germany, you haven't led on the environmental benefits of packaging. Now, by the way, I think in many cases it's best not to do that. Make the product interesting and allow consumers to work out the environmental benefits for themselves, which are fairly salient with use after all. You know, you're not throwing cans in the bin. But was that a conscious decision as well? Because you could make a very, very strong environmental case. I suppose you could argue, well, water bottles have the same effective benefit.
Yeah, well, we have actually done that. So, I mean, maybe to just explain to people who listen to the podcast why we have an environmental advantage in comparison to pre-filled flavored beverages from the supermarket is because one pod flavors at least 5 liters of water. And for that, we use very little plastic, and the pod itself is very lightweight and small. So it also, we can transport a lot more flavored beverage in one container than you could do with pre-filled beverages, right? So we have quite an advantage. The thing, though, and there we go again into behavioral science, is that people see, in most cases, a plastic bottle with plastic pods. So the first thought of a lot of people is, okay, this cannot be good. So we actually have to explain a lot why it actually has advantages. But at the same time, there's a lot of skepticism around it, which I understand.
Sensibly, they've tried to inject the word single-use plastic into the vocabulary of the consumer because it's a daft distinction. I mean, plastic, the fact that plastic lasts forever, okay, is a great thing if it's a repeated use product with a long shelf life and where the consumables are effectively very small. I understand that. Yeah, I think there's a danger quite often in environmentalism where the great is the enemy of the good, you know, where you have, you know, if you have really extreme opinion which demands absolute perfection in everything. Actually, that can be a barrier to progress because people aren't yet ready to make the full step. But there's nothing to stop you, I suppose, making decomposable containers ultimately, but one step at a time.
Well, it's quite complicated, to be honest, because the problem is that our pods contain the natural aroma. And it's quite hard to keep the aroma inside of the pod So it has to be a material that doesn't diffuse the aroma right away. And with composable materials, that's often the case. But what we going to do and going to introduce next year is a bio-based pod.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose aluminium is the other option. It's very interesting working with Nespresso because they get a lot of grief about using aluminium pods, which I do recycle assiduously. But actually, aluminium is good because now technically PET containers are recyclable. The only trouble is that recycled PET isn't much cheaper than brand new PET. So the incentive to recycle it isn't very great. In the case of aluminium, recycled aluminium, because the cost is in the initial smelting, okay? Recycled aluminium is about 10% of the cost of creating aluminium from bauxite. And therefore, there's a real market for used aluminium containers. And so as a result, aluminium does get recycled, whereas PET, if you put it in the recycle thing, the chances that it actually ends up in another bottle are, you know, not all that high, to be honest. So yeah. This is another problem, which is consumers take a kind of very, very knee-jerk reaction to what's good or not. And actually, if you dig a bit deeper, their own kind of instincts aren't very reliable as to what's really sustainable or not, that's always a big marketing problem. But this is absolutely brilliant. It's a fantastic thing. I will actually, my PA, Anna, also wants a shout out because she's hugely grateful to you. Both their kids have one of these. They take them to school every day. They evangelize to their friends. And they really, really enjoy them because, you know, to be honest, to be fair, not, to adults as well as kids, I mean, plain water, there's a problem, which is that the water supply to homes in countries like Germany and the UK is kind of a miracle. You have drinking water absolutely available on demand. It's an absolutely astounding achievement technologically. And yet the downside is that water on its own is kind of boring.
Yeah.
And as I said, I grew up in Wales where the water was delicious, you see. You know, soft water, and it is kind of like getting, it's effectively like getting Vittel on tap. It's absolutely lovely. And then I moved here to just outside London where the water's much harder. And I've never found tap water remotely palatable until now. So, I mean, huge thanks.
I think one thing to add to that would... What we get a lot as comments from people is like, well, you know, why would I need your product? I mean, I can just put a slice of lemon into my water and then I'm fine. No. And it's like, yeah, do it. But not a lot of people do it, right? I mean, there is a gap also between reality and how people would like to or think about themselves, how they behave and how they consume. But fact is, by the end of the day, that I think in Germany, I read a statistic that in 2022, the average per day consumption of like fizzy and flavored beverages was 330 milliliters, which is like a consumption of 30 grams of sugar, while the recommended intake is already below 25 grams of sugar. So there is a gap between reality and, yeah, how people...
Do you have any other innovations? I think Rob was keen to know whether you had a plan to do a kind of a Stanley-style... chili style insulated version.
Well, we have a steel bottle, so we already have.
You got that. Oh, fantastic!
We have an insulated thing, but so how we see our future is we agreed upon not being just a one product company. So you know what we did right now was to build out our portfolio to the left and right. We created new flavors. We created new materials, colors, and so on and so forth. But we definitely see the potential in the company and the technology to actually make the next step to tap into new product categories.
Bit of a hack. Does it work with sparkling water if I put carbonated water in? Is that an option?
Yeah, it actually works a lot better with sparkling water.
Ah, interesting. I might try that because I was wondering about getting one of those quicker taps, which actually dispenses sparkling water
on
demand.
We have them in the office. I love them.
Yeah, they're absolutely brilliant. This is fantastic. Well, this has been an absolute joy. Without giving away any trade secrets, do you have any other plans for, brand extensions in other fields? I think you're probably doing pretty well as things stand, but this is fascinating.
We have a lot of plans. That's never been our problem. The problem is how fast can we execute upon them?
Of course.
But So yeah, in the product segment, there's huge potential that we still see. I'm now working on the product vision, so I'm very excited for that and too excited to again think rather long term. But then, of course, we're also going to further internationalize. We are now also at a point where we invest more into brand and not performance marketing. So we kind of build up a little bit, build out our funnel when it comes to advertising. So we're also thinking about more brand partnerships. And yeah, we're excited to see what's going to happen in the future.
This has been absolutely fascinating. I'm so pleased by your success. It's such a, not only is, you know, for something in a, effectively in an academic project to lead so quickly to fruition, but to succeed so fast is a real joy. So Lida, thanks so much for joining me on the podcast today. It's been an absolute pleasure. You've been listening to On Brand with Alf and Rory Sutherland. If you want to do business with Air Up or any other drinks brand, contact the Alf Insight team on their website, which is www.alfinsight.com. That's www.alfinsight.com. And you can also find the link in the episode description below. And as ever, the series is produced and superbly edited by Ultimate Content. So to make sure you receive the next episode, do just subscribe and tweak our little algorithms by giving us a little bit of a like if you've enjoyed what you've listened to. All that remains for me to say is thank you for listening and speak to you next time. Lida, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it as well.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.